Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 58, we feature an interview with NBC's Lee Dixon to discuss the brand new Arsenal documentary about the famous 1989 season. Plus, we have news about Rebecca Lowe's temporary replacement at NBC while she's in Korea for the Winter Olympics. And Facebook is making big moves to try to acquire soccer rights and much, much more. Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer. I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaya. Kartik, before we jump in, I do want to mention that a couple of weeks ago, we had the interview with Kyle Martino on the show. Obviously, somebody that has been working for NBC, so it's a good sweet spot for us in terms of interviewing somebody that is working in television and is now running for the USSF presidential election. I do want to mention that we have, it's open. So if there's any other candidates that are interested in being interviewed in the 3 weeks that we have left before the election in February in Orlando, which we'll be at covering, they're more than welcome to contact us and we'd love to interview them. Kathy Carter is somebody I reached out to in December to request an interview, and we're still waiting. It's basically on Kathy Carter's side. Her press people have been delaying a response, and we keep on asking. So hopefully they'll come to a decision pretty soon so we can have a chance to interview her and hear her thoughts about the presidential election, U.S. soccer, as well as the TV rights side of things, and lots of different questions there. So, Kartik, before we jump in, anything to add in regards to, 3 weeks to go, we're going to be there before you know it.
Yeah, and I think that there are a lot of good candidates. I think all eight candidates have some virtues to them, including Hope Solo. I know some people really are agitated about her candidacy. But I think there's a lot of thoughtfulness coming from multiple candidates, and the discourse between them has been raised. I'm particularly impressed. I will say this. I'll single a couple guys out. I'm particularly impressed by the thoughtfulness of Mike Vinograd and Steve Gantz. So, but there's still a couple weeks to go, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, definitely. We'd love to chat with them on the air, if at all possible. So before we jump into what we've been watching this past week, Kartik, I do want to mention that I think it's important to give some love to Be In Sports. They're often a broadcaster that gets, a bad rap in the United States. A lot of people complain about the accessibility of the network and the production values and this, that, and the other. I mean, I think soccer fans always have complaints about anything and everything. But from this past weekend, and not just this past weekend, but for several years, but this past weekend, I was kind of thinking about this a little bit more. And thinking about how undervalued they are in many ways, because with beIN Sports, we have television access now to, everything from La Liga, Serie A, Ligue 1, the Turkish Super League, so on and so forth. And in addition to that, they put in a lot of hard work in terms of all of their other programs, the shoulder programming that they do, the extra each night. And this past weekend, watching Kay Murray hosting The Extra and having Thomas Rongen and Gary Bailey there doing their analysis in the Coach's Corner, showing highlights from this past weekend's La Liga matches, and then also showing highlights from Premier League matches and other leagues from around the world. I really think that they're doing a lot of hard work. It's getting unrecognized in many ways, but to me, it's great to have still a relatively a soccer network. Yes, they have other sports, but to have a network that's primarily soccer that you can tune into every weekend or every day, and there's always soccer on, as opposed to ESPN, which we'll get to in a little bit. But a lot of these big games are not on television. They're bumped to ESPN3. Same thing with Fox. I mean, unless it's the World Cup or the Champions League or Major League Soccer, some of the other games that they have the rights to are bumped to Fox Soccer Match Pass, so on and so forth. NBC's got the Premier League, and it's kind of Premier League all the time, but it'd be nice to have NBC pick up some more rights to other soccer leagues from around the world. But anyway, that's just something I kind of thought about this past weekend. Just want to give some love to beIN Sports. All right, Kartik, so let's jump into what you've been watching this past week.
Yeah, so obviously Friday we had two interesting games going on at once, which is a rarity on a Friday. We had a match between Hertha Berlin and Borussia Dortmund, which was an entertaining match, a match that Hertha Berlin would have won had they not I'm trying to replay this in my mind, but obviously Solomon Kalou puts a shot on goal, beats Berkey, and a guy who's in an offside position decides to tap it in. Right. So that's disallowed rightly. And then Dortmund comes back and equalizes a few minutes later. But that was a very entertaining game. At the same time, Derby was playing Bristol City with our friend John Champion on the call. And that was a bit of a dull draw. Obviously, Bristol City going ahead, looking ahead to the League Cup second leg where they played very, very well against Manchester City. A match, I still have not seen, but I do know the results and saw the highlights on ESPN FC late last night when I watched that. Brighton-Chelsea on Saturday morning was a entertaining game, a really unflattering scoreline for Brighton. It didn't do them justice. I thought they had some real quality in this match and looked good at times. Watched a fair amount of Bundesliga at 9:30 Eastern time, as well as there were Premier League games, Premier League matches going on at the same time, Burnley and Manchester United, which was a pretty good game in the first half. I mean, Burnley really had opportunities, it seemed, early, and then after falling down 1-0, had a couple of opportunities, but were defeated 1-0. Man City Newcastle on NBC over the air later in the day, Arlo White talked about his return to the States. So that was maybe the big highlight from that match, which was kind of a dull match otherwise. Southampton Spurs and Bayern Werder Bremen on Sunday were interesting matches to keep an eye on. I thought ESPN's coverage and of the USA-Denmark game, Chris, was very good, women's game, on Sunday night. Now, Seb Salazar and Julie Foudy have now worked together a few times, and they're finding a chemistry, a sweet spot, both calling the matches, analyzing the matches, and then doing some advocacy. So I was particularly taken by the conversation between Salazar and Foudy about what the Danish women had to go through to get a fair collective bargaining agreement, or what we would consider an equivalent of collective bargaining agreement, having to sit out a friendly, which then got canceled, and then had to have a strike, a player strike, against Sweden in a World Cup qualifier. And Foudy believes it was the only way to make the point to the Danish FA. This thing had been going on for about a year. The FA hadn't budged. As soon as that happened and they went on strike, presumably they're going to be forced to forfeit this match, right? They'll still go to a UEFA tribunal or what have you, but presumably it'll be a 3-0 loss for Denmark. The Danish FA caved into the players' demands. And unfortunately, as they talked about on air, this is the only way you can make the point in the women's game to not be treated as second-class citizens with your football associations, which I think, again, to me means when it comes down to it, you're in a situation where players have to take the power upon themselves in the women's game, which is an issue in this U.S. soccer election. Equal pay is just one component of it. So I thought that that was a really good conversation that was had.
I missed that game. I didn't see it, but it's great to hear that, because in many ways, I think ESPN sees themselves as, yes, they're a sports broadcaster, but they also see themselves as having a platform to have intelligent conversations and discussions about topics that sometimes are a little bit uncomfortable. But it's an important platform to have those type of conversations on national television, and I applaud them for that. I mean, that's great. And Seb Salazar, Julie Foudy, we're big fans of, because they speak their minds. It's a lot of honesty, a lot of transparency. They are what they are, and you hear that and see that on television.
Yeah, it was about 15 minutes or 20 minutes into the match. They went right there and spent several minutes on it talking about this issue, which was outstanding. And right, that's what you get from ESPN, which you sometimes don't get from other networks that cover the sport. Speaking of which, the next day, Max and Herc podcast, Hercules Gonzalez from about minute 40 onward, really exposed a lot about the Jonathan Gonzalez saga. I don't want to get too deep into it here. I just recommend our listeners, if you're interested in the Jonathan Gonzalez issue, which I've been on a number of other shows to discuss, or just in general, the scouting and recruitment from the U.S. men's national team perspective, you're going to want to listen to this. Again, Hercules Gonzalez, one of our favorites here, because he speaks his mind. He does his reporting. He's objective. He's not beholden to anyone in U.S. soccer, in Major League Soccer, in any entity. And he's shown that again here with some really fantastic independent reporting. And Max Brados has always fantastic job on there as well. So really big week for ESPN. No League Cup semifinals on ESPN 2 because of the Australian Open and contractual obligations. But ESPN FC has been able to really kind of, because they obviously have the bumper rights to the League Cup, focus on their ESPN FC shows on these second legs of the semifinals. So there's been some really good discussion on those shows about Chelsea, Arsenal, how the Conte situation is affecting Chelsea, how of course Henrik Mkhitaryan's arrival and perhaps Aubameyang's arrival affect Arsenal. So again, this isn't a plug for ESPN, but check those shows out as well.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that today we're recording this podcast on a Wednesday. We're going to release it on the Thursday. But the UEFA Nations League, also they had the draw live on ESPN3 this morning. It was at 6 o'clock in the morning Eastern time. So I missed it live, but I did catch the draw afterwards. And we'll talk about that in our news segment. But ESPN's definitely still got some really enticing soccer rights, and I really like their coverage. So in terms of some of the other things that I've watched, Kartik, last week I watched the FA Cup replays. We had the Chelsea-Norwich game and the Swansea-Wolves game, which I listened to on the radio commentary through the Swansea City website. Also watched Copa del Rey matches, Espanyol against Barcelona from the first leg. Of course, Ray Hudson commentating this one, and one of the lines he mentioned after Espanyol scored the goal to win it 1-0 in that first leg, he said that there'll be some hoochie-coochie in the blue side of Barcelona tonight. And of course, it's a Barcelona derby, so typical Ray Hudson there. Leganes against Real Madrid, watch that match too. Like you, watched a bunch of the Premier League matches over the weekend. Also saw Calgary against AC Milan, Schalke against Hanover, Real Betis against Barcelona. Again, Phil Shane and Ray Hudson commentating that one. That was an enjoyable one in terms of how good Barcelona is to watch this season. Swansea against Liverpool, Kartik. I watched this one on Monday, and I cried. I was. This has been such an emotional season. Really depressing. Last season was depressing, and I think back in October, I said on this podcast, I said they're going down. The only salvation they might have, maybe, is if they got a managerial change, and maybe that might make a difference. But at least they're fighting, and that's the biggest thing for me is if they are going to go down, which is still possible, and they might stay up. At least they go down fighting, and it's been much more of a positive performances under Carvajal from Swansea, and. I do want to point out, though, that NBC kept on butchering Carvajal's name. They kept on, I think it was Liam McHugh and Robbie Earle, and they kept on saying Carvalho through the entire broadcast, which was kind of irritating.
Now, we know his pronunciation. I've watched him for years at Sheffield Wednesday and rate him highly as a manager. I actually told you that when Swansea hired him. I just thought Swansea doesn't have enough to stay up quality-wise, but if they're going to stay up, they've hired the right manager. How do we know how to pronounce his name, though, Chris? The day he was hired by Swansea, Derek Ray was hosting the NBC studio, and Derek Ray gets every pronunciation right. And those of you who aren't familiar with this, Derek Ray takes time and a half basically to make sure he's got every pronunciation down properly and to kind of the ethnic preference of the player. So yeah. So that's unfortunately, for better or for worse, the standard that everyone's judged against.
Yeah, and Derek Gray, I think some of our listeners already know this, but some may not, though, is it goes to the nth degree in terms of getting the pronunciations correctly. He will contact the embassies, the foreign embassies. He will talk to the players. He will that's one of his missions in terms of perfection, making sure that pronouncing the name correctly, which is, you mean, something simple, but in many ways, most of the commentators and most of the people within the industry don't go to that length. And we saw with NBC too that they're just as liable to make mistakes also. But anyway, great game. Really enjoyed it. I mean, they had a game plan. They executed it perfectly to perfection. It wasn't pretty, but it worked. And now there's hope, and actually there's some more positivity about this team. And they've been probably one of the worst teams. No, not probably. Definitely the worst team to watch this season in terms of how boring they've been under Paul Clements. But now there's a little bit of a ray of hope.
Yeah, I also want to point out, I forgot this when we went over my viewing for the week. I thought it was a really interesting discussion this week between Liam McHugh and Steve Bauer, who was joining them live from the BBC newsroom in the pregame, in the at about 2:30 Eastern time, talking about managerial changes, the potential sacking of Pellegrino, the Silva situation, the Paul Lambert coming into Stoke situation. It was more insight than we typically get in one of those segments. So it was, and part probably because of circumstances, right? There's a lot going on right now. But it was, that was very, very interesting. And also to hear Bauer's views on the decision by Manchester City to just drop out of the race for Alexis Sanchez, a player they thought they had on two different occasions in the summer and then again beginning of January, partly because Pep doesn't want to upset the dressing room. And he's got in Kevin De Bruyne, I think, a player right now that most would consider one of the best in the world. You can't come in and pay somebody who comes from outside twice as much as him. So that's part of the balancing act now.
Yeah, and the timing of that, those announcements was perfect. It was just about an hour before the broadcast began for NBC Sports, right. Which is not because of NBC Sports that they made those announcements at that time. But I think I'm sure the clubs looked at it and thought, okay, we got a big game today on a Monday. Let's announce it. You mean an hour before most broadcasts begin, and then that's the talking point. That's the lead story for those that pre-match analysis, which is what we got from NBC Sports. So speaking of NBC Sports, Kartik, let's move on to our TV streaming news.
Yeah, so as was talked about during the Newcastle-Manchester City match at the Etihad on Saturday on NBC over the air, NBC Sports has made the decision about who will temporarily replace Rebecca Lowe while she's on hosting duties for the Winter Olympics in Korea. The temporary lead presenter for Premier League coverage from now until early March will be Arlo White. So he will be coming back from England to host in the Premier League studio, which he has done before. Now, when Rebecca Lowe was on Rebecca Lowe was on maternity leave in 2016, he did about half that period and then went back to England, and Steve Bauer did the other half. Steve Bauer's availability now, I think, is a little less generous for NBC's purposes. So Arlo White's going to be coming back and taking that whole period between now and early March.
Yeah, this one is interesting. That actually is a little bit of a surprise, Kartik, because I thought it was going to be a slam dunk for Derek Ray to get this. And when Derek Ray did do the temporary host over the holiday period, he was good, but he was a little bit stiff, a little bit almost like too rehearsed or too scripted in terms of the teleprompter. And of course, Rebecca Lowe is very relaxed, very, I mean, it's reading the same teleprompter, but in terms of her presenting skills are much better. Now, Arlo White, I think, will do an excellent job as the temporary fill-in for the presenter at NBC Sports. And I think Derek Gray, then, it's up to Derek Gray. I mean, this is an opportunity for him now, hopefully with NBC Sports, to get some of those high-profile games on the weekends that Arlo White was getting before. And we don't know for that for sure, but I would imagine that's what's going to happen. You got Phil Neville that's not going to be involved in the co-commentary now that he's taken the England women's national team job. So we'll have to see. Derek Ray paired with maybe Lee Dixon or Graeme Lasseau. Yeah, I mean, Derek Ray's the best of the best when it comes to commentating, so it's actually a good fit. And again, it goes back to what we've been talking about for a few months, Kartik, and that's keeping things fresh at NBC Sports, because they did get a little bit stale, and this is perfect timing to freshen things up.
Yeah, if you're a fan of the Phil Neville appointment for the England women's national team job, don't read The Guardian, because it seems like they're crusading hard against him first getting the job, and now that he's gotten the job, some of his tweets in the past and his qualifications, etc. So that's just a little sidebar.
Yeah, to me, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's the same thing with Ryan Giggs. I was opposed to Ryan Giggs getting appointed to the Welsh job. But now that he's in that position, I'm going to support him. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and hope he does well. And the same thing for Phil Neville. I mean, he has experience as a manager, as an assistant manager at Valencia. He does know the game. But people are trying to crucify him before he's even managed or coached the game.
Yeah, I think it is an odd appointment, but I would point out that it's not like he was the first choice. Hardman has elected to stay with Canada, shifting from the women's team to the men's team. Obviously, Laura Harvey, who I thought would take the job, especially when she left Seattle, has decided to take the job at the new Utah team in NWSL. And I know there was a third high-profile candidate who I'm blanking out on that has also turned them down. So, Manchester City's manager, Nick Cushing. So that's three. That's at least three I know of. There might be several more. So maybe cut him some slack. I don't think it's quite the same thing with the Wales job, though. Chris, I do think, however, Wales, the progress Wales made, Chris Coleman deserves a lot of credit, right? But the progress they made was because Gary Speed, who was always an inspirational figure for Welsh football, had that job until he passed, for the 18 months before he passed. I think so much of it had to do with that. Gary Speed had no coaching experience, right? Brian Giggs actually has more coaching experience at a far higher level than Gary Speed did. So
for like three games, I think. Yeah.
Well, no. But he was an assistant. He was an assistant under Van Gaal. Who's don't discount that. Louis Van Gaal, he might now have a bad reputation because of however it ended at Manchester United. Although maybe he'll be redeemed by Mourinho's behavior, right? Maybe people are looking at Van Gaal more favorably. But he spent 2 years as a assistant to Louis Van Gaal. I'm sure he learned a lot in that period. Since he had those three games as manager. I still would not have hired him, Chris, don't get me wrong. I'm just saying I think he has more experience than Gary Speed had when he got the job. We saw how well Gary Speed did as a former legendary Welsh player. So,
yeah. But my point is, in terms of just like the press trying to crucify Phil Neville, which I think, to me, just give him the benefit of the doubt, let him give him a chance to see what he can do. And the same thing for Ryan Giggs. Rather than what happened in the past with Gary Speed and others, it's just, you know, now that he's been appointed, just get behind him, support him, and hope for the best. And actually, Phil Neville, I'm going to miss him on the co-commentary. I thought he did really, really well for NBC Sports. So
I agree.
All right, Kartik. So let's move on to the next news item, and that's beIN Sports has grown its overall reach in 2017 by 9%, increasing the total number of viewers from 71 million in 2016 to 77.2 million in 2017, with more than 500,000 minutes watched in 2017. beIN Sports networks have the highest percentage of soccer programming among all other cable sports networks in the United States. Which is true. I mean, it's pretty much all day, all the time, soccer. And, of course, they've gotten into other sports, too. But primarily, it's got to be, like, what, 80, 90% of their programming is filled with soccer.
Yes.
Both on the Spanish network and the English network.
Moving on, Facebook has recruited the chief executive of Eurosport to make a multi-billion-dollar push to help get digital rights for the social media network. The appointment has been made before the deadline for bids for rights to stream Premier League games in the UK. This appears to be Facebook concentrating on Europe to acquire rights to soccer leagues, so right now it's not going to have an impact in the US, at least not yet. I have to tell you, Chris, in another one of my roles as a writer, as a soccer analyst, I've been looking at this Facebook move this week. So it's pretty interesting. There's a lot of speculation about what they might do. And I hopefully will have some written content and also obviously some audio content for this podcast on this when the time comes, because they are going to make a move. It's just a question of how aggressively and what they acquire.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because, I mean, you look at Facebook and you, I mean, it has, over a billion people, the reach. I mean, it's actually gigantic. I mean, much, much bigger than Twitter. But when you think about it, if they were able to get, say, global rights to a specific league, and it doesn't have to be the Premier League, maybe, say it's, I don't know, La Liga, global rights, in terms of how they can get those games into households around the world would be staggering. Now, the challenge that they would have, I think, in many ways is that, well, two challenges is one, if they do pick up regional rights, so say they pick up regional rights to La Liga, this is hypothetical, in say, United Kingdom, and then they have to lock those down so that people outside of the UK cannot watch those games, those La Liga games through Facebook. Which is a shame, because I'm sure everyone on Facebook would be posting about it, saying, hey, here's the link, check it out. The other challenge I think they're going to have, too, is that the way that Facebook is set up today is it's not very video-friendly. Yes, you can watch the videos, but if you don't know where to find them, it's very difficult. And they can improve upon that and change that and fix that, but it's not going to be a slam dunk overnight, just as we've seen with the Champions League games that have been on Facebook. And we've had people posting on Facebook, I can't find it, where is it? And people are posting links to illegal streams when Facebook and the Fox are showing it live on
Facebook is so difficult to navigate with that stuff, honestly. Yeah.
So,
I mean, I don't use Facebook very much for that reason, because I can't find anything.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, so they're definitely moving down that path, Kartik, like you said, too. And it's, they're hiring all the big guns to actually acquire these rights. And then I'm sure, hopefully, behind the scenes, they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we best broadcast these? How do we best set these up to succeed? Should be interesting times to watch, and definitely going to be a big player, as is Amazon Prime and other broadcasters, too, on the digital side. Now, speaking of streaming, Fubo TV has added 9 more local NBC networks to its legal streaming service in the United States. The addition of the 9 cities means that the over-the-air NBC network is now available to 48% of U.S. households. Those 9 cities includes one of my own, West Palm Beach, so I can watch the Saturday 12:30 Eastern Time Premier League game on NBC locally through Fubo instead of on NBC Universal. So that's great news for me. And of course, now I can access all of the other over-the-air NBC programming. So that's a big one. And every week they're adding more and more cities, and hopefully they'll be adding more and more local of the Fox affiliates too, because with the World Cup coming up this summer, having Fox over the air available through streaming is going to be huge.
Commentators JP Del Cameron and Shep Messing have revealed that they will serve as managing directors of a United Women's Soccer League expansion team in Farmington, Connecticut. The club, who don't have will play the Eastern Conference against clubs from Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. By the way, Connecticut keeps coming up as a potential expansion market for NWSL. Nothing has happened there, but anytime I have conversations off the record with or on background with people around NWSL, which is the top division in the U.S., that market comes up, or the Hartford market, more specifically.
So some sad news this week, and that's Jimmy Armfield has passed away. He was 82. He had a long and very spectacular career as a footballer, making over 500 league appearances for Blackpool back in the day when Blackpool was one of the best teams in England, to being on the World Cup squad for England when they won the 1966 World Cup. Then from his playing career, he moved into a managerial career, and he picked up the pieces actually at Leeds United after Brian Clough left the club and helped Leeds get all the way to the European Cup final in 1975, and almost beat Bayern Munich, but there was very controversial circumstances where, about the referee, I mean, it was one of those games where it could have easily gone Leeds' way if the referee was fair in that one. Then he began a career as a soccer commentator, and that's where I knew him best in terms of hearing him every week for 30 plus years on BBC Five Live as well as BBC World Service. And I just want to play a snippet of his voice too, because I think a lot of the listeners may not remember the name, but they may remember the voice. And when they hear the voice, they might go, okay, I remember that guy. But let me go ahead and play a short clip of Jimmy Armfield.
He maybe was right in that.
Footballer of the Year in 1967, Charlton retired at the age of 37. And like others in the World Cup squad, he went into management. He was easily the most successful of them all.
I was a staff coach with the FA from the age of, I think, about 20.
There you go. So it's a very, I think it's from Yorkshire, but definitely a Northern English accent, and someone, unfortunately, that passed away this week, but definitely a legend. And anything to add there, Kartik, in terms of your memories of Jimmy Armfield?
Yeah, I was actually disappointed when he passed away that all of the discussions were about Blackpool and about 1966 in England. I threw out a tweet saying, hey, I mean, I remember Best is the guy that really recovered a horrible situation for Leeds United and got them. They only finished 9th or 10th in the league that season, the Clough year that he took over, but got them to the European Cup final, which you mentioned it was controversial. I think they were flat out robbed in that match against Bayern, as they had been 2 years prior in the UEFA Cup final against Milan. Leeds has had a very unlucky record in Europe. We can even fast forward to the David O'Leary years, right? 2001 against Valencia, right? But very unlucky. But that's my memory of him, is more about his management and recovery of that great Leeds. And thankfully, the next day, the Guardian ran an memoriam by Gordon McQueen, who, of course, is one of the great players on that Leeds. One of the players who, by the way, had been most open to Brian Clough and not hostile in his 43 or 44 day reign that preceded Armfield. And he had some very, very touching and nice things to say. So I was glad that I don't want to take credit for it because I think other people are thinking the same thing. But I threw out there a tweet Monday morning saying, hey, what about Jimmy Armfield, the manager, not just the player?
Yeah, definitely. It's from a player to a manager to a commentator, somebody that will be definitely missed. And for me, again, personally, it's just I remember him more as a commentator. But and then I would often read about him as a player and then or hear interviews about him as a manager. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance, not old enough to actually remember those times. But as a football commentator on the radio, just an iconic voice and just somebody that will be duly missed.
The next episode of This Is Football, the series on NBC, SN, hosted by Joe Scarborough, will air on Saturday, February 3rd at 2:30 p.m. This one will focus on the North London Derby, featuring the fans, culture, and history of Arsenal against Spurs. We've seen the preview for it, Chris, and I have to warn our listeners, Piers Morgan will be featured.
which is funny, though. I laugh, though, just because And probably NBC Sports doesn't know this, I mean, because they've come into soccer relatively late. But Piers Morgan, who for two seasons did studio analysis for Fox Sports, for Fox Soccer, doing, I think, usually FA Cup, they bring him in the studio.
Or whenever Arsenal played.
Whenever Arsenal played, and then Arsenal would be losing a halftime 2-0 or something like that, and he'd go on this huge rant about they should sack Wenger, and then the final score was that Arsenal won like 4-2 or something like that. And I mean, So I mean, there's a lot of, that's just part of the baggage. There's a whole bunch of other baggage, but I was disappointed to see that they interviewed him because I'm like, oh, of all people, you have to interview Piers Morgan. Oh God.
Sorry, Chris. I don't know if you were making that up or you remembered, but it was 2-0. They were down to Spurs. He goes on a rant, makes a complete fool out of himself, and they win 5-2.
Yeah.
It was that match.
Right.
I remember that distinctly. And then there was also his infamous tweet about Aaron Ramsey. He's a complete liability. I don't know what Wenger sees in this guy. Ramsey starts scoring after that, a goal in every game. So that tweet has come back to haunt Piers Morgan many times.
Yeah, and this is going back to the days when Fox Sports, and they really honestly thought this, that bringing in Piers Morgan to be the studio analyst for a halftime show, you mean, for the FA Cup. That was the reason that the ratings increased by, say, 10% or whatever the number was, which is complete BS because, you mean, to me, I don't think people are tuning in to watch Piers Morgan. It's depending what the game is that day, that's what people are tuning in for. And to spend who knows how much money to bring him in, I think it was just ridiculous. But I won't go on a rant anymore about that. All right, Kartik. So a FIFA official this week has said that there will be VAR at this summer's World Cup. But his mention of this was premature, given that it hasn't been agreed upon yet. IFAB, which is soccer's rule-making body, must approve the VAR system for the World Cup at its annual meeting of representatives from FIFA and the four British associations on March the 2nd. And FIFA supposedly also is looking at finding a advertiser, a sponsor, VAR brought to you by who knows who, I don't know, Jamie Vardy, something. So that's where we're at. It looks like it's going to happen. But it'll be interesting, Kartik, because France has gotten rid of their goal line technology system because they've had a whole bunch of issues with it not working. And we've talked about this too. The German one, there's been a lot of criticism about that. Major League Soccer, which is interesting too, because I saw a Soccer America post this week saying about how great it's been. But with the Major League Soccer system too, there's been a lot of question marks about when it's used and why it isn't used at certain times. And of course, the Premier League is looking into it. Serie A has been using it. So there's lots of different types of systems that are being used. And it'll be interesting to see if it does happen, which is the one that the World Cup or FIFA picks. I know in FIFA, they'll probably pick one of their own that's completely different and it'll all confuse us.
Yeah. Final piece of news this week. The most interesting groupings from the UEFA Nations League, Germany, France, and the Netherlands. That's a group of death. Spain, Croatia, England. That's a group of death. Portugal, Italy, Poland. That may not be a group of death, although it is interesting. I think obviously most interesting will be to see how Italy fares against two nations right now who are quite frankly better than they are in Portugal and Poland. Games will begin in September of 2018. We've talked about this before. There are very, very few friendly dates left for UEFA members, thanks to this. If you want to see the whole Nations League draw, go to a news outlet, including ESPN, who is the rights holder in the dates. I'm actually getting a little more excited about this tournament as we get closer to it. I thought it was a strange idea at first, but now I'm realizing it's going to give us some good competitive international football, and like anything new, it has to grow on us. So once they kick a ball, I think we'll get genuinely excited about this. What do you think, Chris? What are you looking at from a Welsh perspective in this?
Yeah, so Wales is in the draw with Republic of Ireland and Denmark. Ireland that obviously just in this World Cup qualifying was the team that knocked Wales, well, advanced into the playoffs, through the playoffs, and ultimately got defeated. But I'm looking at this as it's entertaining.
And defeated by Denmark, ironically enough.
That's right. Yeah. So it's very, very familiar there. So it's going to be competitive. I mean, so even like looking at the Germany, France, Holland, I mean, Spain, Croatia, England. I mean, these are good matches between good teams. I think it's going to add a new level of excitement to these friendlies. I think there's going to be more anticipation about watching these games because there is going to be more meaningful results of this. And for teams like Wales or Scotland or other teams, there's an opportunity here to qualify for Euro 2020 through this UEFA Nations League, and as you get promoted up from like one tier to the next tier to the next tier, etc. So I'm excited. I want to wait and see when the first matches kick off how this whole thing fits together and kind of the rhythm of these games and the timing of these games and how they're promoted, etc. Even though we had the UEFA Nations League draw today, very little fanfare, very little excitement on social media. And it was something I had to kind of seek out to find out the actual draw results. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I'm excited, and I think it's going to be huge. I think it's going to be a really big, exciting tournament to watch. It adds a whole new level of excitement.
Right, and there's a promotion and relegation between A, B, C, and D. It's too much to explain here. Just check it out, ESPN FC, Guardian, wherever you get your football news.
Yeah, and also, it's to me, it will kill the... Anytime you mention the word friendly, a lot of the MLS fanboys will say meaningless friendly. And I totally disagree with that. Yes, there are meaningless friendlies that happen, whether it's club soccer or international soccer. But oftentimes, some of the friendlies and the best games I've seen in my life have been friendlies. And it's still two teams on the field. And for this international side of things, in terms of the UEFA Nations League, I think it does away with the whole idea of a meaningless friendly. These are friendlies, but really they're competitive matches.
Well, they're not friendlies.
Right, exactly.
They were friendly dates, but they're not friendlies.
Right, exactly. All right, so let's move on to TV ratings. Some big numbers this weekend out of Liga MX. Last week we had Walter Franco on the show to talk about Liga MX and Landon Donovan. But some big numbers. 1.3 million people watched Necaxa against Chivas on Univision and Univision Deportes on Saturday, which is huge. 1.1 million people watched Pumas against Club America on Univision and Univision Deportes. And then you had some big numbers, too, from the Premier League. So you had Man City against Newcastle on NBC over the air. That one had 890,000 viewers on Saturday. And then you had Burnley Man United, 452,000 people on NBCSN. Southampton against Spurs had 428,000 people on NBCSN. That game actually was on Telemundo, too, and that one had over, I think, 250,000 people watching that one, too. So big numbers when you combine the two together. And then the U.S. women's national team against Denmark on ESPN, like you mentioned, Kartik, on Sunday, that one had 304,000 viewers. Any analysis there or anything interesting that jumps out of you?
Not really. I mean, I think... It would have been nice maybe to see a bigger number for that NBC game on Saturday, but the number for the NBCSN games both were pretty high, relatively speaking. And keep in mind, Burnley Man United was running concurrent with an Arsenal game on CNBC.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so let's move on to listener mailbag. We've got one piece of mail this week, and this is from Josh Denz from Buffalo, and he posted a review of the podcast on iTunes. And Josh said, love watching soccer, but as a social media enthusiast, I especially pay attention to pre- and post-match coverage. Having professional opinions to listen to and compare to my own opinions is a fun thing to have. It's a podcast unlike any other. Highly recommend the pods to any soccer fan. Keep up the good work, lads. Well, Josh, we appreciate your kind words and posting that review on iTunes. It is unique, and actually it's funny because we're getting fewer viewers than our Premier League format that we used to have for many years. But the amount of feedback and listener mail that we do get is far greater than anything we've ever had with the Premier League coverage. So it's different, it's unique, it's its own niche. I enjoy doing it, and we enjoy bringing the news and analysis to you, the listeners. So if you do like it, even if you don't like it, just post a review on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it. And if you have any feedback, whether it's questions, comments, you name it, let us know at web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can send us an email there. You can tweet us at World Soccer Talk and message us on Facebook through facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. And we would love to read those out on there. All right. Coming up right now is our interview with Lee Dixon about a new documentary that's been released in the United States on Amazon. It's called 89. It discusses Arsenal's famous 1989 season that built up to that final match of the season against Liverpool at Anfield. And against all the odds, something miraculous happened. So we'll have Lee Dixon talk about that, as well as his coverage and analysis and his work with NBC Sports.
We're honored to have Lee Dixon with us today. We're going to discuss his NBC and ITV, among other things, commentary in a few minutes. But first, let's start on this documentary from Universal, 89, that is being released shortly. And I think everybody listening knows the story of that epic match, Arsenal-Liverpool, and how things ended in the 1989 season, arguably the most dramatic finish in the history of a first division season in England, probably rivaled by 2012, obviously, with the two Manchester clubs. Lee, let me ask you, in the lead up to the game that week, obviously George Graham, known for 1-0s, kind of defensive tactics, you're going to Anfield. What did he say to you guys to get you ready to try and win a game by 2 goals and go after Liverpool, who at the time were the gold standard in English football?
Well, we had a little bit of a break, because obviously due to the Hillsborough disaster during the season, that's why the game was moved to the end of the season post FA Cup, because of that delay. So there was a little bit of downtime from a training point of view. It wasn't intense leading up to the game. It was quite relaxed. He took all the pressure off the players. George was brilliant at putting the pressure on and demanding the best out of you as an individual and the team. And he was a disciplinarian, very demanding in what he expected on the training pitch and again on the pitch for matches. But that week he was a little bit laid back. He was a little bit more relaxed. And the players sensed that. I think that put us in a quite a relaxed frame of mind. I think also that the fact that the scoreline that we needed to win by 2 clear goals was such extraordinary to go to Anfield and try and do that. I don't think we'd lost by 2 clear goals for a long, long time there. We were certainly the team of that era, an absolutely phenomenal football club, and everything they seemed to touch turned to gold. So the pressure was a little bit off us in that respect. And I think the flip side of it was kind of put Liverpool in a strange frame of mind, where normally they just went out and played their game and won most of their matches he played on. They were on a phenomenal run towards the end of that season anyway. So they were playing catch-up. They'd already caught us and gone past us. So, and they only needed to lose the game by 1-0 and they would still win the league. So it was a slightly weird atmosphere for them to play in as well. So I think the combination of those two things put that week in quite a surreal place. Certainly leading up to the game, we were really, really cool, and there seemed to be no pressure on us. George kept saying to us, you know, everyone's expecting us to fall over. We've already had 2 bad results leading up to that final game, drawing at home against Wimbledon and losing the game before against Derby. So he goes, you know, the people are looking and they're saying they've already lost it, and it's Liverpool's to just pick the trophy up. And there was certainly an element of that when we turned up at Anfield that night. It was a feeling of a celebration from the Liverpool supporters. It felt like that, and I think that put us then into game mode just before we kicked off. And George gave a brilliant pre-match speech, which, you know, we'll talk about in the documentary. That he basically said, you know, keep it tight in the first half. We don't have to come out and score 2 goals straight away. They'll be expecting us to come at us, and we won't. We'll just play our normal game. 0-0 at half time is a good result, and then if we can try and get a goal early in the second half, put a bit of pressure on them, they'll start to worry a bit that we only need one more goal, and then we'll go and pitch it at the end. And it was kind of like, we looked at him when he said that, you know, we kind of looked at him hoping that deep down we'd believe it, but in our heads it was kind of like, is that really going to happen? Well, we might as well give it a go. We're here now, so let's, you know, get straight for the game and put our kit on and see what we can do. And lo and behold, you know, the rest is history.
As your career went on, you and Tony Adams on that back line for Arsenal, inextricably linked, gave so much of the spine, right? Nigel Winterburn too, right? All of this in terms of character and building Arsenal into not only a title-winning team in 1989, but then the team Arsene Wenger took over winning 3 titles. Talk a little bit about your partnership with Adams and the rest of the defenders and that season and how it came together that year.
Well, George wanted to build a team from the back, he's that idea, which is a little bit strange because he wasn't that type of player. You know, he called him the stroller. He used to play around, score goals. He was very sort of lackadaisical in his style. Discipline, you wouldn't have thought was the first thing that come to mind when he was putting the team together. But he had a vision of building a back four and a defence, and making it solid. And in order to do that, we did defensive drills, the four of us, basically on our own every single day of our lives. Very rarely got a day off from a regime point of view. It was kind of back four work, warm up, back four work, and then we might get a little bit of joy and go and join in with the rest of the lads and do a bit of extra clean work, and you know, maybe a bit of shooting and crossing and shooting. But back four was we were drilled. It'd take us to a pitch, the four of us, we wouldn't even have a ball. He'd put us in our line across the pitch, and then he would have the ball under his arm and he would walk all over the pitch, and then every now and again he would jog into certain areas. But all he was looking for was to react to where the ball was and what we would do if the ball was in this part of the pitch and it was moving towards maybe me. Where would Tony Adams go? Where would Steve Bolt go in reaction? And he had this sort of visual picture of us all tied together by a piece of rope. And he would keep going on about a piece of rope. They're all tied together. If one moved over there, you're holding the piece of rope, and your mate comes with you at the same distance. And if somebody drops towards the penalty box, you drop with him because you get pulled back by the piece of rope. And it's kind of a visual picture that I've got to this day. And every time I talk to young players about the art of defending, I talk about this piece of rope, and they all look at me and they're like, "I've gone mad." But you can see the penny drop after 3 or 4 minutes of chatting to them. They go, "Oh, I get it now. So if I go there, Tony hasn't got any choice. He has to come with me because I've got the end of the piece of rope." And they say, "Yeah, that's it." And then, and he goes there because he's putting cover up for you. You're putting cover here. And we did it day in, day out. And it was almost, yeah, it's so boring, I have to say. But you know, when it comes to Saturday, we'd all line up on the pitch. And you're kind of doing it without knowing that. You see the ball in a certain area. Ryan Giggs might have it. And he's running at you. And I know that if I go towards Ryan Giggs, Tony Adams is being pulled behind me and just to the left of me, putting the cover on. So I know if I show him inside towards Tony Adams, he will be there because he's got no choice. Because that piece of rope has pulled him into the right position. And it's genius, isn't it? It's absolute genius. It's so simple. And yet, you have to drill it into the muscle memory to know, and the mind memory to know where you are. And that's basically what George built the team on. And the rest of it was disciplined. But that back four unit was, you know, we took the brunt of it in training, and we're quite happy to do so because we believed that, he kept saying that we believed in him. He said, "If you do this, not only will we be successful, we'll keep the ball out of the net, you will get cover in front of you, and you'll play till your mid-30s, and you'll go on and on, because I'll make sure the guys in front of you work twice as hard as your work is." And lo and behold, I was 38 when I retired, and I think a lot of that to do with George.
You used the word surreal earlier to describe the week leading up to that final match, which we must remember and note had been delayed because of Hillsborough, and 1989 lives in so many people's memories, not only because of that match, but also because of Hillsborough and what happened on April 15th. But talk about your feeling and the feeling of your teammates when Michael Thomas's goal goes in. Is it just as surreal? Is it disbelief? Is it realization that you've won the title? How did you feel at that moment?
In all honesty, it's a disbelief mixed with incredible emotion of we've actually achieved it, and then quickly covered over and washed over by the waves of panic, because you then think that the worst is going to happen, and we didn't really know how long to go. We knew it was at the end. Literally just before John Lukic got the ball, and I talk about this in the documentary, that I just asked the referee how long to go when John Barnes went running off into the corner and should have put it on the corner flag and the game was over. But he didn't. He tried to, typical Liverpool way, he tried to dribble in the box and score another goal. thankfully, Kevin Richardson.
You don't know how many Liverpool supporters through the years have mentioned that to me when I mentioned the game, when I mentioned 1989. Well, we love Barnsley, but if he had just gone, John Barnes had just gone to the corner, it's over. But history is what it is. Good, continue.
Yeah. Well, you also, which I didn't know at the time, and making this documentary and interviewing and speaking to people. I did some radio interviews in London, and John Aldrich was on the other line on the radio, and he was telling me, and we've talked about John Barnes, and I said to him, what about that? You're giving him a load of stick after, or at some point, why didn't you run into the corner flag? And he said to me, did you see me? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, watch the video when you replay it time, and I've seen it, must have seen it 50 times. And I never realised that as the ball goes back to John Lukic when they took the ball off Barnsley, John looks up and he was exhausted. He couldn't kick the ball anyway. That's why he threw it. He looked up and threw the ball to me. But if you watch, John Aldridge is standing right in front of John Lukic when he throws the ball, and he actually puts his arms up to stop him throwing it to take a free kick and a puck in and just away side because he knew the game was over. So he puts his arms up to block the throw, and then realised last minute, takes his arms down and went, oh no, they won't score from this. And I've never seen it before, and I rewound it, saw enough, both his arms go up to try and stop him throwing it, and then he puts them down, ball comes out to me, and then we all know what happens from there. But when the ball actually eventually goes to Michael and he's going through on goal, I'm just thinking, it all goes into slow motion for me then, because I've hit the ball to Alan, Alan's flipped it inside, and then Michael's made this run, he's got the deflection, and he's now through on goal on Grobbelaar. And he just missed the chance 15 minutes earlier that he should have scored, but he didn't. And he's running through on goal. I'm now about 40, 50 yards away, just jogging up the pitch because there's nothing I can do now. My game's done. And I see him going through, and I was thinking, why are you running in slow motion? He looked like he's running treacle. And I was like, put the ball in there, because I saw he's about the edge of the box, and I can see Houghton coming in, Steve Nicol coming in, they're all converging on him. And I swear to this day that Houghton gets his toe on the end of the ball and kicks it away for a throw-in. And every time I see it, and I've been to 25 viewings of this film now, every time I see it, I think he's going to kick it away. And I've actually went to the photographers who took some pictures behind the goal. And you'll see the photos we sort of brilliantly in the doc. They bring the photos alive. So the photo is a still of Michael putting the ball in the net. But they somehow make the ball move. I don't know how they do it. It's very, very technical. I wasn't in on that day when the geniuses did that. But you see how his foot literally touched, the end of his toe touches the ball as Michael flicks it over Grobbelaar. It's so tight that he gets the ball away. It's incredible. And as I said, when the ball goes in the net, I see the net go, because I see him running off. I know it's him because I see Nigel Winterburn start running with his arms up, even though the ball hasn't hit the net, because he's up there, you can see the ball going over the line. And as soon as the ball goes over the line, I've talked to you about all those emotions and what I was going through. I immediately, very professional of me, immediately burst out crying on the halfway line. I just couldn't stop myself. I just had this overwhelming rush of emotion, and tears start flowing down my eyes. And I run back to the halfway line, to my spot, thinking, oh my God, if the kickoff can come down my side, I'm not going to be able to see anything because my eyes are watering. And luckily, they went down the other side and they got another, put the ball in the net, put the ball in the goal for another, I think, like a throw in and then a cross. And then Michael gets the ball in the edge of the box and coolly, like a cucumber, just rolled the ball back to John Lukic. He kicks you up the pitch and then all hell breaks loose because the final whistle goes. So, and I can't really, in all honesty, I can't really remember much happened after that. It's just that I have to watch the video to actually see what I did, who I was. And I remember the one thing, and you've touched on it, but there was a huge amount of respect going on before the game, obviously paying tribute to the 96 who lost their lives. And we handed flowers out before the game to the cop and to the supporters. And there was almost a permission given by the Liverpool fans to, like, pay your respect, thank you very much, now we can get on with this game. That's because we were very conscious of the fact that probably a lot of people thought it was the right thing that Liverpool won the league that season. They'd just won the FA Cup, Hillsborough had happened. It was kind of, do you know what, it's probably meant to be. But that handing over the flowers and that permission that they gave us to say, right, we're playing football now, let's go and the best team win. That for me was, I remembered that when the final whistle went, and I remember, because I've watched it, I can't remember where I was running, what I was doing, and I saw myself going around shaking hands with the Liverpool players and making sure that the excitement didn't take over the moment. It was a moment to say, look, it was a fair game, and we've paid respects to you now, and then we'll go off and enjoy ourselves, you know, outside the stadium and in our dressing room or whatever. So I do remember that moment being very in tribute to the 96 that lost their lives.
A few weeks later, actually maybe 6 weeks later, you traveled here to Florida for preseason, and I saw you play against Independiente, and it was a match which, quite frankly, had an excessive amount of security in the wake of Hillsborough, in the wake of Heisel and the Bradford City fire, because people in the United States, they had very negative and I would say skewed stereotypes about English football. So we had excessive amount of security here for that match. Do you remember that match and that trip well at all?
Well, I don't remember the actual game itself, apart from the fact it was about 120 degrees.
Yes.
I've never played in heat like it. And it was just because we were training really early in the morning to try and avoid the heat. And we would literally go onto the pitch in our training ground and do 2 minutes work and then run into the shade, and we're just basically doused with a hose pipe. And I kept looking at the lads going, literally a minute of work and you couldn't breathe and you couldn't run. It was just ridiculous. And that was the highlight of that trip, or the biggest memory of that trip, was how hot it was. And I remember starting the game and the Argentinian players were like running around as if it was like the middle of January. It was just, they were like, yeah, it's nothing but even sweating. And I was like, we're so not acclimatised to this. We really are going to struggle. And you forgive me, but I don't even know what the score was at the end. Did we draw 1-1?
I believe so. Quite frankly, I can't remember either. I just remember being so excited that the champions of England were playing a game in Florida. I was a youngster at the time. I was in middle school. I was starved for high-level football in my community, so I just remember being excited about going to the game and knowing about Michael Thomas and having seen the clips of that, albeit having seen the clips a week or two after it happened. That's the way it used to be in the States. Fast forward.
I don't think it's sort of at our best, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case in preseason in general often. Fast forward a quarter century, Lee, and you are co-commentator for NBC Sports. As the Premier League explodes in the United States, as it becomes, quite frankly, a mainstream sport, not only football as a sport, but the league itself becomes a mainstream happening on American television. Talk a little bit about that, how you feel being a part of the growing revolution of the Premier League on television here in the United States.
Well, I've been very lucky. When I finished playing, I started working for the BBC in England, and then moved over when they lost some of the rights and moved over to ITV Sport, who then had a lot of TV rights over in the UK. And I was lucky enough, I got approached by NBC when they first got the rights, probably 4 years ago, was it now, or something like that?
Yeah, it's about five now.
And Pierre, is it 5 years ago? Wow. Pierre Moussa, the production guy over in the States, came. We had a meeting in London and said, look, we want to set this team up. We want to be the best. We want to throw our resources at this, because they saw the vision of what the Premier League could be, what it was in England, how popular it was, and said, we want to do this thing really, really well. We want to get the best guys in. We want to do this. And I was in from the day one. As soon as I met with Pierre, he sold, he didn't have to sell Premier League football to me, but he sold the American market to me, and he said, look, this is it's going to be on NBC. A lot of the games will be on national TV. We've got NBC SN as well. This is going to be big. We want to grow the game. The whole ethos about him and the NBC team was to grow the game to what it is or what it could, its potential in the US. And I've got a lot of attachment to the US. My wife's a US citizen. We have a house over here. I'm in America right now. So I was like, yeah, I really want to be a part of that because I see my future maybe being long-term over in the US anyway. So this is a perfect opportunity for me. And so I have to say, and I'm not just saying this because I'm speaking to Americans, et cetera, but the level of detail at NBC, it has to be right up there with the best sports broadcasters I've worked with. And there's nothing left to chance. Everything is given to you, every opportunity. A little bit like Arsene Wenger, really, in that respect. He gives you every opportunity to be the best you possibly can. There's no stone left unturned. And then it's up to you. You know, Arsene can't kick the ball for you. Pierre and the team over there can't make you talk intelligent football talk to the nation. You do that bit yourself. But the opportunity and the platform to do it has been absolutely second to none. And as you said, 4 or 5 years down the line, the game has grown. The level of every year we have a kind of assessment of where we're at and how we're doing, and we always, every single year, we always go, yeah, brilliant, we've knocked the lights out, not good enough, what are we going to do next, how are we going to make it better, how are we going to push the envelope to being better at giving this brilliant sport to the Americans the best we possibly can. And I absolutely adore working for them. Most of my work is co-coms in England. We've got a brilliant team. And I forgot one thing. That was one of the things that, in the meeting with Pierre, first of all, which I didn't want to be involved in, was I don't want to Americanize the game in that respect. So I said, look, if I'm going to work for the company, then you need to get me, you need to get Lee Dixon talking about what I know, which is football, Premier League football. That is what I know. So please don't ask me to call it soccer or to call it anything other than that's normal for me. And I will try and share my experiences as a 22-year pro in the game and share that with the American public. And that's what. And he said, that's exactly what we want. We don't want to do. We want them. So that's why Carl Martino, obviously played for the US national team, he's a brilliant analyzer, knows the game inside out. Front of house, he's the only American we have at the front of the camera, and the rest are all English based. So we're bringing, you know, the Premier League to NBC as we see it. And I, when I watch American football in the UK, I want to listen to Americans talk about it because they know the game. And there's a guy, I can't remember his name, who broadcasts the NFL in England, and he's brilliant. He knows the game inside out. He presents, and the players know he knows the game. And I listen to him, and I know he knows the game because I can just tell. And yet, I still go, yeah, but what's the American guy think? Because he grew up with it. I believe that's the way to broadcast. Listen to, I'm not saying that Americans don't know football. They do, but they can talk from their point of view. My point of view is play 15 years at Arsenal. I'm going to share that with you. And when I see something on the pitch, you know, I will share it as knowledgeable as I can and get it over in a language that people hopefully can understand.
Final question, Lee. As someone who grew up in the Northwest, how amazing is it to commentate on and see Manchester now as maybe the capital of world football?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was born in Manchester, and I grew up as a Manchester City fan, season ticket holder, the old main road. So I've got a lot of affection for that blue half of town. Not so much for the red half, although I'd like to think I'm pretty impartial when I come to commentate. And it's a brilliant. That's all the Premier League has been waiting for a while, because now Man City has caught Manchester United up in lots of ways, still behind in other ways. But two, as you said, giants of European football, they're now going, hopefully get to a head-to-head State at some point. It looked like it was going to be a bit closer at some point this season, but Manchester City have been absolutely phenomenal so far. It's not over. We've all talked about Camden Court, and I do think they'll go on and win it, but I think there'll still be a couple of twists here and there. We're hopeful anyway. But it's great for the game, and Chelsea's not going anywhere. Arsenal look like they're rebuilding again. Tottenham, when they get the new stadium, is going to be a force to be reckoned with again. It's such an amazing place to play football. And Liverpool will do what Liverpool do best, and that's give you everything and then give you nothing the week after.
And on that note, Lee Dixon, we by the way, for those listening, we're recording this less than 48 hours after Liverpool's result in the Liberty Stadium. Reference to that, obviously. We thank you for your time, and the film is 89, Universal Film.
Okay, Kartik, so where can listeners find you on the internet?
You can find me at KKFLA737 on Twitter. DMs are open, so feel free to send me a DM, or at worldsoccertalk.com and other places on the web.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. And like I said, if you do enjoy the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. We would greatly appreciate it. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.